Okay, we're now recording. This is Ted Everson interviewing Henry Tremeer, CEO of Genzyme in Cambridge, on May 23rd, 2006. Mr. Tremeer, thank you very much for agreeing to this interview. I wanted to start with some discussion of your early years, your early education in the Netherlands. First of all, I know from our prior meeting you mentioned you were born in 1946 in the Netherlands. Can I get your specific date of birth?
February 28, 1946.
Okay. And your specific location?
I was born in a town called Tilburg, T-I-L-B-U-R-G, okay. In the Netherlands.
Tilburg. And did you live there during your childhood?
I lived there during my childhood. Mm-hmm. Through an age of 19 or 20.
Okay. And Tilburg is a small town, is it near?
Medium-sized town, 140,000 people at the time, I believe.
See.
The eighth largest town of a very small country.
Right, okay. It's, is Tilburg sort of the main center in the region that you were living, or were there
no,
other larger,
there,
larger
there
towns?
There are other towns around it. A town better known is Eindhoven, where Philips has its Philips technology, electronic technology, has its headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
Other towns are Breda and Sertinbosdeo. All these towns are about the same size.
Right.
It is in the size of the Netherlands. It is very close to the Belgian border.
Mm-hmm.
It's right between Amsterdam and Brussels.
Okay.
And there's a university. There was at the time, university that was primarily focused on social sciences like economics. Now it has broadened into all kinds of different faculties.
I see. This is the university in Tilburg?
In Tilburg, yeah.
Right. Okay. Maybe we can talk about your childhood a little bit. Your parents, what were their names?
My mother's name is Mary, and she's still alive. She's 92.
Mm.
And my father's name is Jack. He passed away some 8 years ago.
Okay. And what were their backgrounds?
My mother was born in Canada. A small little town at the moment, it escapes me the name of it, outside of Calgary, from Dutch immigrants, they lived there for a while. Then my grandmother got difficulties with her eyes, and doctors then felt it was due to the that the very sharp air or skies in the Rocky Mountains there was not good for her eyes. She needed the Dutch clouds. When my mother was about 5 or 6, they went back to the Netherlands.
Mm.
And it was very sad in a way, because her father had left and had given up an interest in the family business. And then, of course, they went on this adventure.
Right.
And when they came back, they had to start from scratch.
Hmm.
And my father was born in the Netherlands, stayed in the Netherlands. His father had a small shoe manufacturing operation.
I see.
He became active in that, and then they met and eventually produced 6 children.
Mm.
And I was number 4.
Just curious about your mother's background again. So her family moved to Canada from the Netherlands, and then she was born in Calgary.
Outside of Calgary. Tiny, very tiny little town, still in existence, really in the prairie. she still recalls meeting Indians and, you know, people that were quite long. This goes back now a while,
right.
80 years plus. They had a ranch in the,
right out there.
In the wilds.
Right.
My grandmother, my mother's mother, was a great adventurer. She did not want to sit still. And it was her urge that convinced her husband, my grandfather, who I never met, to go on this immigration adventure and to start a new life. And they were very happy. But and my mother's brother actually went back to Canada many years later. He was born there as well, went back to the Netherlands. Then, when he was in his 30s, he left the Netherlands with his family and went back to Calgary.
Hmm.
And that's where he has been. He died not so long ago.
I see.
So they were very connected to Canada,
right.
Always.
Hmm. I lived in Alberta for a while myself. Lovely area.
It is lovely. It's space, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. You know, big horizons.
Yeah. And your father's ancestors?
My father's ancestors,
they were from the Netherlands.
They have a book going back 500 years or something that they can trace back this to the near family. It's not a prominent family, just a normal family, but they were able to reconstruct the family roots.
Right. And your father's roots, were they in Tilburg and around?
They were around Tilburg, yeah.
Yeah. And you mentioned, sorry.
That's where my mother's roots. They were
right,
around
okay.
Tilburg too.
I see.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you mentioned six children.
Six children. I was number four.
Mm-hmm.
The first two girls, then four boys. I was the second boy. And they are, for the most part, still in the Netherlands. Also, my eldest sister has been living in different places around the world and settled now some long time ago in Rouen in France. So she lives in France.
Mm-hmm.
So, and most of my brothers and sisters kind of connect to France. One way or the other, I have second homes there and they spend a lot of time in France. So the French connection grew over time. For no
right.
particular reason, other than that it is a pretty country.
Mm-hmm.
so now we are divided up between France and the Netherlands.
I see.
I'm the only one here.
Mm-hmm. So do you go back?
Very often.
Yeah.
We are very close.
Mm-hmm.
We have a very good relationship, including the grandchildren and the grandchildren. And, everybody knows each other. We keep in contact. They all, in relative terms, done well professionally, and are very independent.
Mm-hmm.
But we like to get together. We get together for big reunions and for smaller reunions, just the brothers and sisters and spouses,
mm-hmm.
and my mother. And then at other reunions, we get together with all the grandchildren. You know, it's a big crowd.
Big ones, right?
Yeah. Quite regularly. Including me inviting them here. They come here.
So oh, that's nice. And your sister's names?
My sister, my older sister's Inike, is I-N-E-K-E. My second sister's Marlies, M-A-R-L-I-E-S.
Mm-hmm.
My elder brother is Bert, B-E-R-T. My younger brother is Paul, and then the youngest is Ruel, R-O-E-L.
Sorry,
R-O-E-L.
E-L. Okay. Great. And your mother, was she employed? Was she?
She was not employed. No. She was at home.
Right.
She was a good pianist. see, you're asking here something about music.
Mm-hmm.
She played piano, as were all the kids were asked to play the piano too.
Uh-huh.
It was not successful. So, but we had, we used to make music. It was always great fun, the whole group.
Mm-hmm.
I played the trumpet for a little while, not very well either. And I tried the violin, because my father had played the violin. And that was too hard on everybody else's ears. So I never became a music person. But we did have, on the point of how we were living as a family, we just my parents really liked performing arts, so we would go to concerts and to ballets and to the theater
right.
all the time as a family, as a group. We were quite Catholic. The family would go sit on the front row in Catholic church every Sunday morning, and we went to Catholic school as well.
Was that at the time a private school system, or was it public, or was there a distinction?
I don't know quite. I don't remember whether there was a distinction.
Right.
It clearly was run by priests and by people in black outfits. It was, and the Catholic Church probably had a great deal of to do with how it was run, because it was financed publicly. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I was curious because my my home province of Newfoundland,
uh-huh.
I'm Catholic as well, and our schools were public schools, but different school boards were run by different denominations.
Okay.
So they were public schools, but Catholic schools.
Yeah, this may well have been very similar.
I think it was quite common.
It was a very, very strong Catholic influence on these on this school, and they were very good schools. They were high discipline kind of schools. So I have actually good memories of my time in primary school.
Right. And what was the what were your schools? What was your primary school?
The school's name. If you killed me, I would know. I think it is St. Thomas's. St. Thomas. The Thomas School, St. Thomas, yeah, I think so.
Right.
And then the St. Christopher School, there were two. I moved one and then I moved to another. And there was Montessori School where we went, each of us had to go to Montessori before going to primary school. And that I don't remember too much of.
Mm-hmm. And after
then
primary,
the high school was St. Adolphus, also Catholic.
St. Adolphus
Lyceum, Lyceum. And after high school, that you then went on to university and whatever you did next.
Right. Can I ask about the age differences between you and your siblings?
Yeah, the first four are 1 year apart each. And then there was 5 years nothing, and then there were the last two.
Okay.
In good Catholic fashion, my mother had two miscarriages. Mm-hmm. That's why there was a hole.
And your brothers, Paul and Roel?
They were 5 years apart? 1 year apart.
And when you went to university, did you have to move away from home? Did you?
Now, let me explain. In Holland, there was at that time national service, military service.
Right.
So when I came out of high school, I went to do the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
And I was fortunate to be selected to go to officer school. So you either became a soldier, stayed a soldier, then you had to go for 18 months, if you became an I think it's called under officer here, like a sergeant,
mm-hmm.
you would become, just 12 months, 18 months, and 2 years. And if you become an officer, you had to stay 24 months
okay.
and 2 years.
Right.
But you got real training, and you became an officer in charge of a number of different things, which became very important to me in my experiences.
Mm.
So I went to a military service to do my 2 years, which everybody had to do at least a year, but
mm-hmm.
I chose the 2 years in order to become an officer, which was really a very, very nice
right.
Experience. And then after that 2 years, I went to university.
I see.
To do economics.
Right. And for military service, where did you do that? Did you have to travel away from home to do?
Not out of Holland, but yes, I did leave home. I went to Breda, which was pretty close, for the basic training, the boot camp.
Mm-hmm.
And then to an air base, which was actually even closer to the town. And then I went to The Hague, to an air base there for most of the time. There I spent about a year and a half.
I see.
Of course, you when you're young like that, to become an officer and to actually be asked to take responsibility for certain things, including managing people
mm-hmm.
or managing operations, that was a magnificent experience to me.
Mm-hmm.
That I remember well how much I learned. I was not a pilot. I was in charge for most of the time I was there after the basic training of all the material movements, all the warehouses on an airbase where they did a lot of plane repairs and stuff. So we had tens of thousands of things that needed to be managed and controlled and reordered to keep these planes running.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had a large group, many of them professionals, of people that did this work, and I was in charge, and I was a kid.
Yeah,
I was 19 years old or 20 years old, and when you just arrive, I remember well that some of these 50-year-olds who were sergeants and had to recognize that you were an officer would
mm-hmm.
kind of resist a little bit, or try you out, or challenge you,
right.
See whether you were really worthy of being their boss. And I remember so well both the observation of the challenging
mm-hmm.
and then my own reaction to it. That helped, I think, in a way that I built a very high level of confidence at a very early age that I was okay. I could manage people, even though
mm-hmm.
I was a little bit younger and quite a bit younger, and get along with people and become very friendly with them and while maintaining a good discipline.
Right.
And the other thing that was a great experience then was because they had so many materials and the computers were not in any way developed in those
mm-hmm.
days, to build systems there were no real national systems how things were done.
Right.
The systems were built literally by us
mm-hmm.
to
sort of inventory controls.
Inventory controls and replenishment systems, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
So that worked. All those were good experiences in terms of the power of processes and the implementation and
mm-hmm.
SOPs and
mm-hmm.
all of those kinds of things.
Combined with all that management.
And the management.
Yeah, it's very impressive experience.
For an impressionable young man, it was great. You couldn't go to a school to learn that.
No, right.
Nobody would take the risk to put somebody in there.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there are always in those services, there are sudden panics or moments where when things are you know, in the military day, I said, create a panic, or there's a real thing going on.
Right.
And those were great experiences, too. And then there was the continuous training in terms of basic health, you know, the survival training and all of that kind of stuff that you had to participate in order to just stay current.
Mm-hmm.
So I had two great years in the military that were formative to me in terms of self-confidence and in terms of probably me saying to myself, maybe I said it earlier too, that I wanted to run something. I wanted to be in charge.
Yeah, I was curious about that. Was that the point at which you thought?
No, there was a point two. I was in the Boy Scouts, and I did take a leadership role in the Boy Scout period too, of course at a much younger age.
Mm-hmm.
And simultaneously at that time, I decided that I liked business a lot, or the processes of business, and I started to read pretty Wall Street Journal like newspapers,
mm-hmm.
or newspaper, there was only one.
Right.
Familiarized myself at a very young age with stuff that I thought I became familiar with, but of course I didn't understand. But I was really reading about all the different things that were happening in mm-hmm. industry.
And this was at a young age, like the
very young
age.
Yeah, that was even before finishing high school. And the thing I did at high school too, I played chess a lot. Actually, I played it fanatically for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
So fanatically that I didn't do anything at school. I failed a few years because uh-huh. I was just going to championships
right.
and play. I played simultaneous, a whole group of people. And I got, again, when you're young, you're very impressionable. And when you become successful, something. People give you compliments. You say that's more important than studying. And
right.
So I bought loads of books and really spent a lot of time learning about chess, reading books, reading about openings, reading about closings, reading about middle plays, and all the different things you can read about.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a local professor at the university, which was then reading economical, they did economics there, mostly economics, who, a fellow by the name of Max Erwin, who became world champion.
Max Erwin?
Max Erwin, E-E-U-W-E. And he became kind of known because there has been only one Dutch
uh-huh.
world champion in chess ever. And he was a theoretician. And I guess I was quite impressionable by that experience and felt that chess was really where it was at. Of course, it was not. It was so bad that I would play chess blindly in my head. I didn't really need the board, so I would sit very attentively in class, and the teachers would have no idea. They thought I was very attentive, but I was
incredible.
Didn't hear a word of what was being said.
Right.
So one day, my mother, who was a very decisive woman, magnificent, very decisive still today, had a long conversation with her early this morning.
Mm-hmm.
She said, enough is enough. And one morning I got up and my chess pieces were gone. All the books, which were on the shelf, were gone. And she said, it's over now. No more chess. And she thought I would terribly react. And she was all prepared to manage that reaction.
Right.
She had told the school I would no longer participate. I would no longer represent the school, nor represent the city and all that. And I actually must have known that this was not a good way to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I was fine. I don't remember that as trauma at all. And I pretty much played never chess anymore since that time. I do it in the paper when I read it, but
right.
I don't miss it. Didn't miss it. Left it.
That's a very decisive.
yeah,
change.
You can actually, I can visualize. So if I look at things that were important to me as events, that chess period, 3 years,
mm-hmm.
And then that suddenly stopped.
And this was high school years? Sorry.
This school, yeah, 13, 14, 15. Or 12, 13, 14. Just puberty time, beginning puberty time.
Mm-hmm.
And so stopped that entirely. I have to say, if I look at influences of my life at that time, my parents were an enormous influence
mm-hmm.
on all of us. And they were very, I think, very talented in how to deal with kids, giving them pretty disciplined input
right.
while being pretty pretty warm at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I've been very, very fortunate in that regard.
And it seems like you were ready for that change. You must have been, if it
yes.
wasn't completely traumatic for you.
Yeah.
Interesting. So, then we're at university with a BA in economics at the University of Rotterdam.
No, I never got a BA.
Oh.
There's no such thing in the Netherlands.
Right.
You go straight to a master's. So I studied economics.
Okay.
And before I finished, as part of actually finishing,
mm-hmm.
I had to go to write a thesis of some kind. Actually, there was a midway point. So I went to England to a company that was like my family's company in shoes.
Right.
And they had many retail stores throughout the UK and throughout, I think, in Canada and Australia and in South Africa, the Commonwealth kind of countries.
Mm-hmm.
The company's called Norvic. It doesn't exist anymore. It is Norvic.
Okay.
And they had a retail headquarters in London. So I went there to write something about the computerization of early computerization of retail stores,
okay.
And the effect that that had on the economics of running those business like that. And
this is for your thesis.
This was for my thesis, and I never returned to go back to school in the Netherlands. Because what happened was I wrote a thing, and then the company asked me to implement what I wrote.
I see.
And there was it was very interesting. This was outside London, Finchley. They had a big conference room. It was a relatively big firm. They had hundreds of stores. And they had they invited three companies to help them computerize
mm-hmm.
their operations because they couldn't keep track of all these inventories
mm-hmm.
and change them, replenish them. And they so they invited IBM, ICL, and Cambridge Computer Services, and they put each of these teams in a corner in that big conference room. And I had the fourth corner. And I became friendly with everybody. They were competing,
right.
but it was a very friendly kind of situation. They each had to develop over a period of a few weeks a proposal how to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I gleaned the best of the best, and I wrote a proposal as well, a system and a proposal.
Mm-hmm.
And I handed it to management, and they liked my proposal the best.
That's great.
So they asked me to implement it.
Right. So the proposal, was that the thesis, or was that followed?
No, that was separate.
Right.
The thesis was really pretty mundane.
Mm-hmm.
I can't even remember much about it. But this proposal I can remember a lot about, because that became the first step in many that this company set to computerize itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very involved with this. And actually was in charge of it. And this was my first real job. So they offered me to implement it. I could choose one of the three firms to help, because I was only by myself.
Mm-hmm.
do the programming and select the hardware and all that stuff.
Right.
And they gave me a salary. Although in the military I had gotten some money, but it wasn't very much. This was the first time I got
right.
money that allowed me to live in a normal, more normal way. Then I stayed there for about 2.5 years, and for one thing came the next. I had factories in East Anglia,
uh-huh.
and I moved there and I computerized the factories, and I set up and what became one of the very first computer service companies in certainly that part of the UK.
Okay.
And so we started to do payrolls for other competing, actually, shoe companies, and to do bills of material and all that stuff.
Right.
And we had a real department that became break-even. So we were able to service the company, and we were servicing many other companies, and they paid normal rates.
Right.
And we were able to provide Norvik with very good service for free.
Mm-hmm. If I could just back up slightly. So what years are we talking about now?
I think we're talking about 68.
68. So you did your economics for a couple of years, and then
a couple of years, and then I went there for to continue to do economics, but I never returned.
Right.
That's why I never finished.
Right.
So
68, you are at this company.
68 to 71, I'm at that company.
In London.
In London for the first. 9 months,
okay.
to a year, and then the remainder in Norwich, in East Anglia. Norwich, N-O-R-W-I-C-H.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And when you successfully got your proposal accepted by the company, did you take on one of the three teams then to help you out?
I took on Cambridge Computer Services,
okay.
one of the three teams,
right.
And they were based in Cambridge.
Mm-hmm.
So I traveled back and forth to Cambridge all the time,
right.
working with them.
Okay.
And in fact, we utilized a very large computer based in Cambridge, and we connected it through telephone lines.
I see. So do you have the technical expertise, the computer expertise at the time? Or were you managing?
I was making it up as I was learning as I went. So...
My
father's and my family's or the experience in the Netherlands had given me some insights into how you automize things.
Mm-hmm.
And my experience at the school when I was learning economics gave me some systems input. But computers were very unsophisticated then. It was really pretty straightforward stuff. I wasn't a programmer, but I was a systems engineer. I could and a manager.
Mm-hmm.
So I brought programmers in from Cambridge Computer Services to do a lot of the work, portion of the work,
mm-hmm.
the highly technical work.
So systems engineering is something that you learned in your economics.
That was part of the kind of background. That was actually, I learned it everywhere. I learned it at the military as well.
Right, yeah.
There was a lot of things that came together. And it was the same problem that we had in the military. These were inventories, and it needed to be replenished.
Mm-hmm.
Or even in a factory where you have 25 steps to produce a shoe, and you have all kinds of different materials that go in. Each step produces, glues a piece of material into the construction of a shoe.
Mm-hmm.
To explode what you need is actually extremely simple, but that was done by hand with all the mistakes that people make. You put it there were no spreadsheets, but you can we were able to actually do this pretty straightforwardly.
Right.
And we were ordering materials on that basis.
Mm-hmm. And so the company transferred, or you moved to East Anglia with as an employee of the company?
As an employee of the company.
But then eventually set up your own computer no, service?
The service was owned by the company. It
right.
was really a department mm-hmm. that became that had two functions: the function of servicing the company,
right.
and was allowed to sell its services to
okay.
the outside.
I see. Right. So the company was.
So we had a real P&L. You know, we were contracting out
mm-hmm.
to other companies, many of them actually competitive, so we had to set up walls
right.
To make sure that that didn't leak. And it was very new, that kind of stuff. So there was a newspaper that wrote a large article on this East Anglia newspaper on this company, on this service
right.
Company that had grown within Norvik. And that was my first, I think, experience was being interviewed for something, because they were quite curious, and I was excited about it.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly exciting was to say we can do this profitably, you know, and service the company and actually break even as a whole, but
right.
sell the services profitably. It was a nice. Again, learning experience about running a business.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of people that I had to attract were not the kind of people that you find in a shoe factory or
no.
a shoe firm. They were different kind of people, and young, most very young.
Yeah.
But also, we needed lots of data entry in that kind of business time, so we needed pretty much people, unschooled people that we brought together for,
right.
for this and trained. So that was a good experience. What it replaced was London, there was a hall in this building, in a building, a very large hall. And in this hall were cart racks.
Yeah.
And every cart represented a shoe, one of the hundreds of... and a particular size,
mm-hmm.
one of the hundreds of storage. And they have holes. And Indian and Pakistani ladies would go in there with these long pins, and they would go in there and like this, and they sort out
right.
What was happening. So they would,
the
card would come back, they would take out the card, and then when they wanted to know how much of anything existed, they would go sort around like this.
Right.
It was very charming to see, really mm-hmm. colorful almost, because
right.
It was a nice atmosphere around it. But you always knew what you had after the fact. You know, it was always too late, and it was always obviously inaccurate.
Yeah.
So that's what we replaced.
Right. Yeah, these are early years for computers. So IBM was one of the three firms you said that
IBM
was
and ICL. ICL, I think,
ICL,
what
right.
ICL became, they were taken over by a larger firm.
Right.
Yeah, IBM was there, and they we worked actually with the 370, and then there was a, you recall, a 370. I mean, these were fast.
Yeah, I remember that one.
Processors,
mm-hmm.
the early processors.
Yeah. So you're working from scratch, trying to set up these systems.
Yes.
You don't, there's no nothing
there's
been done
there. No.
Right.
No.
Fascinating. And so at this point, you are a manager and a systems engineer.
Right.
I guess.
I'm. I was group systems manager. That
group
was
systems
my
manager.
Title.
Right.
So in the process of doing all that, of course, I met somebody who later became my wife, but I also met many other people. Among others, people that were English people that had gone to business schools in the United States and were asked by their business school to do good work for them, or actually recruiting students, potential students to come to the United States
okay.
To learn.
I see.
Or to come here and then return. This was the early days of really international students becoming part of the MBA program. So it was some competition.
Okay.
And that's how I ended up not going back to the Netherlands, but go to United States.
Mm-hmm. If we could talk about your wife for a minute. Did you meet her in London?
In Norwich.
In Norwich.
Yeah.
And her name?
This is my first wife. Since divorce, but her name is Maggie. Miss IE. And she grew up just in that neighborhood.
I see.
Really not much to be said about that. We were there a short time, and then she joined me when I came to the United States.
I see.
And we didn't marry there. We married in the United States.
Right. Okay. And so this is 1971 when you decided to move.
Yeah. I left in September 71.
Right. Any pivotal people that were influential in that decision to move?
The people that introduced me to the subject of the United States really were these people that I mentioned, these ex-students who became recruiters for MBA schools.
Right.
And they were in this new world of computer world. You saw it. So I met somebody from Cornell, somebody from Harvard, and somebody from University of Virginia.
Okay.
And the person at University of Virginia I got to know the best, because that person was living also in Norwich.
I see.
Or came out of Norwich. Was living here, but had family in Norwich. So we were brought together, and he convinced me that going to UVA was a good thing to do. UVA was then a young school, new school, that came out of Harvard, Case Method.
Right, yeah.
And I wrote to them, as I wrote to Cornell, as I wrote to Harvard, and I completed these very large applications, all three schools, and then in the end decided to go to UVA because they were extremely interested in me coming.
Okay.
In fact, we only had 5 foreign students in our class. We had 105 people. 5 of them were foreign students. I was one of the 5. So they really wanted to remedy this shortage of foreign students. And they also offered me a place to live. Marvelous place to live. It was really very nice. Because I didn't know so much about University of Virginia. Didn't know anything about Harvard either, for that matter. I was the name, and Cornell, and you knew nothing about it. But clearly it was by far the best financial decision to go to UVA in the absence of real knowledge. And people were very very constructive in the process of recruiting me to go there.
And were these people actual recruiters, hired recruiters, or
alumni that who had been asked or had maybe volunteered to look around for students that could come to their school.
Right.
And you're pretty competitive. They really did their best to convince you that their place was the best place to go.
Right.
But financially, UVA was much more attractive than the others.
So they gave you a home?
Gave me a home, they gave me a grant for the first year, whatever you call it, a scholarship. The home I had to pay something very marginal. I always was self-sufficient. I always paid for my own way. Throughout the whole years that we covered lightly, I would make sure that I earned. I never really was satisfied to go to a school to sit and then go to the family for money. I would always try and earn my own way.
So did you work in high school and first few years?
I worked in high school. I worked in my family's business in high school every Saturday and earned as much as I could. And of course, in the military, I went there. And then when I studied economics, I worked during the day, studied in the evening, actually learned quite a bit, many of these economical, these system things by working during the day. So when I went to UVA, I did. It was important to me that I could actually do it on my own.
Mm-hmm.
Nickel.
Right.
Now I had earned good money in Norfolk doing that job.
Right.
And I had a nice car at a Lotus Elan, and you know, I had a good life.
Mm-hmm.
It was really a lot of fun. And I saved some money. So I sold everything and had enough money to support myself, to buy a little car at UVA or in Charlottesville. But I could not have done it without the support from the school.
Mm-hmm.
And they made it possible to do it.
Right. Do you remember the name of the recruiter from UVA?
Baker is his second name. I forget his name. It may have been John Baker. Was a tennis player. He actually lived in Greenwich, Connecticut. He had moved there after MBA school, and I met him in the UK only as he visited mm-hmm. his family.
I see.
That's how we got together. So one day we packed up, if that's where you want to go, I'd never been to this country. It was a great adventure. We arrived at Kennedy Airport, I was with my girlfriend.
This is Maggie.
Maggie, almost fiance, I think. We had five cases.
Mm-hmm.
Four were hers and one was mine. We sat waiting in the hall at the Kennedy Airport. We were innocent, like crazy, naive, for the bus to go to Greenwich because to see this Baker
right.
family. That was the first stop we had, and then we would go from there. He would take us to the city, and then he would arrange, or he would make sure that we would get to Charlottesville, which was a long way from there. As we're waiting there, you know, finally this bus arrived to go to Greenwich, and then we want to pick up our case. All the cases, in fact, my girlfriend's cases had been stolen.
Oh no!
And so I had only my case, and nothing. It was very sad. So we were running around in a panic for a few hours, and eventually went with a later bus to Greenwich. And that was a good education immediately coming here. That things went
so
simple.
In New York.
In New York at Kennedy Airport.
Hmm.
We had then no money. We said, okay, let's regroup, and we stayed 2 days in Greenwich, and then I asked him to take us to a bus. We took the Greyhound bus from 42nd Street.
Mm-hmm.
And in September it was still very warm, velvety warm. And we drove the bus all the way to Charlottesville. It was a long way.
It's very long.
And the bus is filled with all kinds of colorful people, of course.
Mm-hmm.
It was very impressionable, those early moments, those first exposures to a completely new country.
Right.
And the distances, of course, are vast. Yeah. This bus trip took forever.
Much unlike the Netherlands.
Netherlands, of course, you would have been there for half an hour. It was very, very, very different.
Right.
It was a great experience. But then we arrived and we started our life there. And we had a good 2 years. And there was one thing that is of note. You know, the 2 years are of note, what I did. But the culture thing that was very Americana. That was too that the this is in the South. It was more South now than now.
Yeah.
But the sponsors were sponsoring me, and they gave me a house behind William Faulkner House, the writer.
Mm.
And it was an old slave cottage, 2 floors.
Mm.
And you lived upstairs and downstairs. There was a room that wasn't used. But they had given it to me, not to me, to live in sin with some other lady. And there was frowning going on immediately as we arrived. And they also told me, as we arrived, we got oriented, that I was going to work day and night, you know, which that particular program is known for. It is very hard work.
Right.
Three cases a day, an examination every Saturday, and pretty much day and night work. And that I would not be able to look after her. And she was told at the border when we came to the airport that she only could stay 6 months because she had not a student visa, she had just accompanying me.
Yeah.
To change all of that, if we married,
it wouldn't be a problem. Right.
Wouldn't be a problem. So, after 2 days there, I decided to get married. And 2-3 days there. And we told the school. And we told our big brother, which was a second year family, a student family, who was looking after us.
I see.
As a host. And they then organized, behind our backs, they said, don't worry about a thing. When I get married, it's okay, it's quick. They organized on Jefferson's grounds, I don't know if you know Charlottesville. It's really quite lovely,
yeah.
You know, the old grounds. In fact, we probably were one of the only people that have ever been married there. They organized this wedding. And they asked me, what do you like? I said, I like classical music, nice, you know, classical wedding. And my wife, to be, said, I like candlelight. And they put candlelights all around in this beautiful classic garden. And they invited all the students and all the faculty. And they had this event for us. Our parents weren't there. And they made it magnificent. And somebody gave us a car, and we had a room in the Holiday Inn in the Shenandoah Mountains there.
It's incredible.
Just for one night. And then we had to do three cases, of course. But it was a tremendously powerful statement of welcome in a country where we had been less than a month.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody knew us. And, you know, giving it really that great embrace. I thought very impressive.
Imagine.
Yeah.
So that was your first impression.
That was the first impression, U.S. Yeah.
And how did you find the MBA then over the next 2 years? Lots of work.
Lots of work. Lots of fun. I did lots of things on the side. They had a little consulting group that worked with companies in the neighborhood to help them, and got some credit for doing that.
I see.
I did some work at World Bank, which is pretty close to D.C. Wrote my thesis, actually, at the World Bank. I did some work with the law school on international law to learn more about how that worked. I audited that. I didn't take any credits.
I see.
And I had two very good years.
Mm-hmm.
I made great friends, learned a lot, and essentially loved the way of teaching the case method. Liked it, and I became more convinced that was the right direction for me.
Mm-hmm. And Maggie, did she?
She did good. Was not allowed to work, of course.
Right.
She did a little bit of babysitting. She helped in some antique stores, and this was tough on her because I was extremely engaged.
Mm-hmm. Becoming socialized in this new world.
Yeah. So that was not so easy. Now, also, we had many friends, but it was a little lonesome probably for her. We had my parents came, of course, her parents came, and we had visitors, which was nice. I worked hard because I needed to earn my scholarship for the next year, the second year, during the first year, in order to get that renewed. Which happened.
And I forgot to ask, did you say that neither of your parents were able to come to the wedding?
No, nobody came, of the family.
Mm-hmm.
and they were all sent pictures by the dean. It was actually in the dean's garden that the wedding took place.
Ah, I see. Right. And so, for your first year, you were working hard, you had courses, you were doing the side work, and for the second year, the scholarship
was renewed.
Yeah,
and so second year was like the first year, with a little bit more elective choices.
Right, I see.
Then in between the first and second year, I did go back to Europe to see whether, because I meant to go back to Europe after the 2 years, and so I was looking for a job.
I see.
So I went to Unilever. To the Economist, the consulting unit of the Economist magazine, Shell, Royal Dutch Shell. Those are the three I specifically remember. And I interviewed with them. But these were very, I recall them as very unsatisfactory. They didn't really have a good understanding what an American MBA meant.
I see.
So that made me think that I probably wanted to go and work for a few years with an American company in the United States after school. And that's how it worked out, because they had a big on-campus recruiting program.
Right.
All the different recruiters from the companies would come, and you know, eventually I ended up at Baxter.
So you recruited straight out of your MBA?
Straight out of MBA, I interviewed with banks, with consulting firms, with investment banks, with normal banks, retail banks. I didn't really know what I specifically wanted to do.
Right.
Other than I wanted to get an experience. I had only a visa for a few years do that. 2 years, I think it was.
A work visa, you mean?
Or to work after school. Right. It was a special indication of that kind of visa at the time. So I wanted to get a good experience and then go back with that American work experience and American school experience,
right,
and then go back to Europe and see what would come out of it. And my last interview on the campus was with a company called Bex.
Right.
And they were looking for people to become general managers in Europe who spoke European languages,
right,
who understood the culture.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a very convincing experience, so I joined in with them.
Mm-hmm. So the possibility of going back to Europe with them as your employer?
That really was
a big one.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So, and this is in Chicago, so you have to move again.
This is in Chicago, so we moved to Chicago in 73, late summer, and I started to work in a job called assistant to the international marketing manager, or marketing vice president, because that's how they dealt with MBAs. They had they recruited MBAs. Baxter was a very rapidly growing company at the time. Also, now it seems very small compared to where Gender is, but it is. It was about $270 million in revenues, and they were active globally, but really at the beginning stages globally. And they made interesting products, artificial organs and kidneys and blood banks and stuff like that.
And this was your first exposure to
very
biological
first
products?
Very first exposure to healthcare products, medical products. And they were looking for people and MBAs, and they were recruiting at 5 or 6 schools. And fortunately, UVA was one of them, Harvard was another, and University of Chicago, Stanford, they had 5 schools they recruited from. And they brought these students over and they made them assistants too, and they created a natural mentorship.
Right.
And then within 6 months to a year, you had to go and move, you would be assigned a more permanent position. And the program was administered or managed by the CEO, Bill Graham.
Bill
Graham. Actually, there's a book written on how this worked by a Harvard Business School professor recently. Came out last year. They're called the Baxter Boys, because the completely disproportionate number of ex-Baxter people started by technology companies.
Mm, yeah, you mentioned that.
And it's actually, for your background reading, interesting to... There's a big piece on me in that book.
The book was focused on...
on careers, on career imprints. You said, right. You go through a career, I did it 10 years, and then you start a company,
right.
Like here, or and you shape a company. And then it was making the case that your early career impressions about many things become reproduced in some form.
You're imprinted and... Imprinted. Interesting.
And it's scientifically written, so it has... a reasonable kind of basis to
right.
it. But anyway, so I joined as assistant two, and I didn't like to be assistant two at all. And I asked for a real job earlier. And so 3 months I became international product planning manager.
I see.
Which is a big title for a young man, and specifically focused on Hyland, HYLAND. And Hyland was making plasma products, isolating proteins from plasma, and diagnostic products.
Okay.
And they were based in California.
This is before the merger? Because Hyland became part of Baxter.
Yeah, but the Hyland was part of Baxter when I joined.
Oh, okay.
That happened well ahead of me.
Okay.
They were one of four divisions.
Right.
The only one not in Chicago. The others were all in Chicago headquarters.
Where were they in California?
They were in Costa Mesa.
Costa Mesa.
In Irvine County.
Okay.
But just before... Let me see. No. So that's what I became, international product planning manager for Hyland. So the thing was, this was a biological activity.
Mm-hmm.
This was the beginnings of biotechnology.
Right.
You know, you take plasma, you pull it apart, fractionate it. And so they did factor 8 and factor 9 and new globulins and albumin. And that's what was then sold. But the plasma was collected through plasmapheresis.
Right.
And plasmapheresis centers all around the country. Many of them were, they paid for the plasma. They returned the red cells and paid for the plasma. The plasma
was then. So these were independent centers that
we owned the centers.
You owned them, okay.
Yeah.
I see.
That's a very big other book you can write about the plasma industry.
I know. Yeah, it's fascinating. Well, I guess during the war it started and then grew quite rapidly.
And of course, there are many cases that this industry wasn't so, you know, what the industry was doing in terms of paying people was somewhat concerning.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, very vulnerable people were being paid. Money for plasma, you can only bleed it twice a year, and of course we'll bleed more than that.
Right.
Really not very, very tough world.
Mm-hmm.
It's a long, crazy situations. Some of the blood came out of Lesotho in South Africa, and Belize, and Nicaragua, and were owned by political figures that... Yeah, it's a longer story, but it's fascinating. And I got very close, and I was actually in charge of aspects of it later on, much later on, and learned a great deal again. But that time, I was primarily trying to figure out ways to make these products, these diagnostic products and these therapeutic products, products that we could sell internationally. So I would go to our subsidiaries, which were very small, and tell them what we have and how to do it and what Salesforce to put in and prepare themselves. And of course I didn't know that much either, so they would learn along because I was not a specialist in these products.
Right.
I learned as much as I could learn.
So your goal was to understand both how to develop them and to market them internationally.
To market them internationally. Mostly market them internationally.
Okay.
And there was one product that internationally was thought to be very important, diagnostic product, was a product for Chagas. Chagas is not spelled like you have it here, but it is C-H-G-A-Z. Chagas disease, which is a parasitic disease, sleeping disease, sometimes.
C-H-A-G-A-G-A-Z.
It's very prevalent in Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
So we thought we developed a test for Chagas disease. That's the feedback I got that we needed to do, and we would have a big market for that.
Mm-hmm.
So I would. They asked me to head up this project. You imagine now, I am a year, less than a year with the company.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say, figure out a way to set up the connections. That was a very big thing to do.
Right.
While still doing the other things. So I would travel to Venezuela, to Brazil, and to meet with officials, and they would, and I would went to the CDC and the military in this country. They had some activities going on because we were concerned about military exposure to Chagas disease. And I learned a great deal, including that we had no business to try and do this. That there was no real commercial market, and that other people really were very focused on doing it. But it was an extremely interesting experience to go into places and to meet completely different people that were motivated to with the science and the healthcare concerns related to this particular disease in very foreign places. So that was the early part of the career, and back to the early year.
Mm-hmm.
Now we are in the year, of course, where the great oil shortage occurred.
Yeah.
So although Baxter didn't have that much sales internationally, it had some sales internationally, they decided that we needed to squeeze the assets to the lowest point of operation, inventories and accounts receivable.
Right.
So that we were the most efficient possible.
Mm-hmm.
And a team was pulled together of five people. One was heading it up, reporting directly to the CEO. And for each of the four divisions, there was one person. And they were pulled out of the general corporation to focus on the project of completely re-engineering how business was done, minimizing inventories, minimizing receivables, minimizing asset and working capital investments. And of course, they asked me to do the Highland piece. Now the other four were more 3, 4, 5 years with the company. They were young, but they were had been there for a while, and I was there less than a year.
Huh.
And they moved me to Brussels.
Okay.
To do this. So we had just bought a house in Evanston. They had also given me an apartment in Costa Mesa, the neighborhood of Costa Mesa.
Mm.
I thought to do that other job because I was going there back and forth all the time.
I see.
So now they also gave me an apartment in Brussels. Mm-hmm. So here was the company.
Right.
Very impressionable. I said, wow, American business.
Yeah.
It's
three
quite
homes,
something.
Always traveling.
Yes. And always traveling. That was a big thing. So my wife and I moved to Brussels over a 3 month period to do this work. And we, of course, I traveled all around all the subsidiaries to set up new systems to do this. And it was an incredible amount of fun because this was such a strange time, and this was such a focused project, reporting directly to the CEO,
mm-hmm.
that you could get a lot done. So it was
right.
really a very good experience. But it lasts only 3 months, then it was done.
Right.
And then they asked me to come back to Chicago, and they changed my job. So we went back to Chicago,
mm-hmm.
And I stopped working for all the Highland stuff and became what was called the international marketing manager for the artificial organs division.
Mm.
Artificial kidneys, you know, dialysis equipment,
right.
And heart-lung machines and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. And so this was at the Chicago
site in Deerfield, Illinois.
Right.
That lasted for a number of years. It was very interesting. Again, the great pioneering work was happening around the world in dialysis,
mm-hmm.
and in heart-lung machines, open-heart surgeries. But it was not too dissimilar from the job I did before. It was just a larger scale and a more senior role, and was a more important moment for that technology internationally.
Right. So was it marketing focused as well? Looking
very marketing focused. Yeah.
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 Same.
And structurally focused. How do you do business?
Right.
You know, how do you get regulatory approvals for things? Because it was amateur hour at the time in terms of regulatory approvals, but you needed approvals to sell these things.
Mm-hmm.
How do you train sales forces? What modifications do you make to the products to make them appropriate for a particular country? How do we react to foreign competition? The Europeans were pretty good in this space, and we competed with them,
mm-hmm.
The Swedes in particular. It was very rapidly growing, so it was a tremendous amount of fun,
mm-hmm.
to do that.
So did you lose your apartment in Costa Mesa?
I lost my apartment in Costa Mesa, Balboa Island, and the one in Brussels, of course.
Yeah.
But now we had a more settled moment in our life,
mm-hmm.
but it didn't last very long. By 1976, I accepted to become the general manager for Baxter in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And that process had started mid-75.
Okay.
When I was asked to look at first in South Africa to see whether I was prepared to become the general manager in South Africa,
mm-hmm.
which was a joint venture. So I spent 3 weeks in South Africa to try and understand that. I was in my late 20s then.
Right.
And I didn't like South Africa. The circumstances, they were very complex,
mm-hmm.
in the late 70s. We had a factory, and you know, of course, these policies and all that, but it was really pretty difficult to visualize. And there was a lot of history between the Dutch and the South Africans, I think. So then they also offered me to set up shop in Brazil. Because clearly, as they had said when I joined, I would become a general manager.
Okay.
And that was really what they were preparing me for. And I was looking forward to that moment.
Right.
And then suddenly, in early 76, they offered me to become general manager in Germany.
I see.
By total surprise.
Yeah.
Because Germany was the largest sales subsidiary, marketing subsidiary, and Germany was the largest market outside the United States. So that was very exciting.
Right.
And the way they offered it to me, and it was interesting for you, but the way they offered it to me was very interesting. I came from a trip in Europe, arrived back on Saturday. On Monday morning, back to the office in Deerfield. And the president of the division calls me in and says, how was your trip? I gave the answer. I was Germany, which was part of my trip. I spent one country a day. That was
mm-hmm.
my usual way. No, you know, they have a lot to learn, but you know, they're getting there. They're certainly enthusiastic. Did you notice anything? And I was not about to say anything bad, but
right.
It was not my business. And how would you like to be the general manager, the Geschäftsführer in Germany? And I was shocked. And what had happened was that, not known to me, the general manager was running that operation, got himself into trouble with unions, and there was a lot of employee strife going on. And
right.
Baxter was very non-union, and they were very concerned about this, and it was very un-Baxter-like to have these problems.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked me, they made a decision to change the management.
I see.
I called my wife, what do you think? And we, that night, I went on the overnight to back to Europe. And that morning, I went to Brussels, picked up the guy in charge of Europe, who was going to be my new boss.
Mm-hmm.
He and I flew late that night to Munich. Next morning, 7 o'clock, or at the airport, he met with the general manager. I had to stand behind the pillar so that he would see that I was there. And they had dinner, he resigned over dinner. I met with some of the management. And the next morning, 7 o'clock, I took over.
Really?
And by 10 o'clock, all the employees had left, except for the management, in a strike.
Hmm.
And big signs appeared, and the women came back all in black clothes, like they were in mourning. And because the ex-general manager was a very nice guy. He was a good friend of mine. He was an Australian. Czech background, went to Australia, went to business school, Harvard Business School. Really smart, nice guy, probably too nice. And but he got himself into problem with the generally some of the employees. But they wanted him. It was kind of schizophrenic.
Hmm.
And so I had he moved out of his office. Since we were friendly, it was not so. It was painful, but it was okay to do. I moved into his office by 10 o'clock. I had a petition being delivered to me with all kinds of signatures.
Just to back up slightly, so you called your wife, and that night you moved permanently.
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay. No, permanently.
So a very quick decision.
It was a quick decision, but I was 29.
Mm-hmm.
And those opportunities didn't come very often. And
right.
And the word permanent is too big a word,
well,
but
yeah.
We didn't sell the house, we rented it out, and became an expatriate.
Mm-hmm.
in Munich.
Yeah.
And it was very exciting. That night, it was a big, it was of course a fight, quite a big moment, but I would, after that day of emotional stuff, I did speak German, which helped
mm-hmm.
greatly. I met people the whole day long. The guy who was my new boss stayed only for a few hours.
Mm-hmm.
And then I turned around, where is Gabe? And Gabe had gone. And he said, you can almost.
Right.
You
know,
that was the style.
Wow.
And that night I got to eat too late. And most places were closed. I couldn't find food. I stopped in the wine cellar and ate a bottle of wine. And I got nicely drunk. I remember it so well.
Mm-hmm.
Staggered to my hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And I was tremendously excited as to do something. I felt very sorry for George, who was the ex-general manager.
Mm-hmm.
But we became extremely friendly afterwards. And things worked out very well.
That's good.
My wife joined a few months later. And I had three very good years in Germany. And of course, you learn a lot in Germany. Germany had big, strong healthcare companies,
mm-hmm.
Local healthcare companies that were competing hard with Baxter. Baxter was trying to make its way in the market, and the Germans were trying to resist it. And so we had all the dynamics of competition.
Mm-hmm.
We did sell all the products that Baxter sold throughout the world, the United States. We had divisions for each of them. infrastructure is much smaller. We had a regulatory infrastructure, we had a clinical infrastructure, we had the warehouses and all the kinds of things that you have to run an operation.
Right.
And it was all Germans except me. It was just great. it was a very good experience.
Mm-hmm.
Company grew tremendously over those years, and I learned again a lot about management really in those years, and gaining confidence, how to do things, gaining independence, and feeling enough away from Baxter in Chicago that I could do my own thing.
Right. Yeah. Maybe a little more detail about what you actually did in Germany. You mentioned that the German subsidiary didn't have a manufacturing facility.
No manufacturing. It had everything else.
Right.
It had a very small research capability that is not worthwhile to mention. Just because of a particular technology in artificial organs, in kidneys, dialysis.
There was
a small unit that was part of it. But it was mostly marketing and sales and distribution and regulatory and clinical development for all the products that Baxter had, and those were the artificial organ products, the Hyland products, the factor 8, factor 9, and so on, the IV solutions, the hospital products, the blood bags. In broad terms, those are the four. And the diagnostics, of course, the four or five activities.
Right.
And they had managers in charge of each of these activities, sales forces and in-house marketing people. And of course, had a financial function. I think they may have had 100 people at the time and a few hundred when I left. 200, 300 people.
I think you mentioned that at this subsidiary, probably the major market you built was for factor 8. Is that right?
Yes. As a subsidiary, we built all the markets, but the one that became very well known was in the corporation because it was the largest single market we had. May have been large in the U.S., was the hemophilia market, which is factor 8. A highly specialized market. And in Germany, you had some very strong leaders, clinical leaders in that space, that brought, upgraded the whole treatment of these patients to world class, or far the best in the world. They went prophylactic in many cases for children, and they were determined to have everybody treated in the very best way possible.
Okay.
So that market developed quite well, and I was benefited from that, coordinating much of the work, clinical work that was being done in terms of proving that early treatment was a good thing to do, and there was a lot of activity. And these were global leaders, so if you had an hemophilia meeting at the time, the Germans were very important participants.
Right. Was this hemophilia specific in Germany, or was this just a general part of German healthcare leadership?
I attributed it to, this may be naive in hindsight, but in the law in Germany at the time, no citizen, if it can be avoided, quite out of language, should be disabled. If you can avoid it, if you can manage the health of a citizen to avoid disablement, they have an absolute right to that. And in hemophilia, that means prophylactic treatment, stopping the bleedings that you may otherwise spontaneously have. I think that Germany was very decisive in the way they looked at the treatment of hemophilia X1. And of course, there was a global shortage of product.
Right. Yeah.
And that drove the price up. So this was not a happy set of circumstances, because the German prices were higher than elsewhere. But their consumption was so much higher than elsewhere, too.
Sorry, the what was?
Their consumption
was much higher.
So other countries would complain that the Germans were cornering this market because it was so rich. You know, Germany was pretty economically was doing extremely well.
Right.
So the appropriateness of all of that, the ethics involved, those were very interesting both observations and things I managed, trying to make sure that the company wouldn't get into this position inappropriately.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because we clearly had an economic benefit.
Yeah. And who were you selling to? Was it this?
To clinicians, to clinics.
Directly to clinics.
To clinics, mostly specialized hematology centers where these patients are
right.
being treated still today. So what did I learn? I learned lots about the ethics involved in. I learned a lot about rare diseases. Learned a lot about the ethics involved in rare diseases. I learned a lot about the history of rare diseases, genetic diseases in Germany, which wasn't so happy either, because in the world, Second World War, citizens with genetic diseases were in a very difficult position in that society.
Mm-hmm.
They were ostracized and often not supported at all. And so many of these families had actually gone in hiding for generations.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot about that, those aspects of genetic diseases. Learned a lot about the kind of the international nature of how these things are being seen, because we were an international company,
right.
and there were international meetings, and the Germans were clearly very, very visible in these meetings, and I was part of that scene.
Mm-hmm.
A lot about what happens when you don't have enough product, when you have more demand than you have product support.
Right.
Something about pricing, political involvement in the process, because this was politically enormously supported, what was happening to this treatment. So there were life lessons
mm-hmm.
that are still valuable today, and impressions that I learned then. More so than the other products. The other products were a bit more straightforward. This was really quite unique.
Right.
This was really biological product treating a genetic disease,
mm-hmm.
And a rare genetic disease at that.
Right, okay. Am I right that factor 8 development occurred at the Highland division
in
as
the
well?
Highland, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you had several Highland connections that I'm assuming are related to your later move.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess, is there anything more we should talk about with the German point, the German history? Are we ready to move on to LA?
We can move to LA.
Okay. So yeah, was it 79?
Yeah, all the time, of course, I knew eventually it would go back. We still had the house in Chicago. I thought it would go back to Chicago.
Right.
And then because of my early history in Highland, the great success of Highland products in
mm-hmm.
Germany, I was asked to go to California to
right.
the Highland division. This time as a vice president of the division in charge of R&D, those research divisions, development division, global marketing, and a number of us regulatory,
mm-hmm.
All of it on a global basis. This was the first time that a division was being set up by Baxter on a global basis. Usually it was the domestic component, and
right.
then the international division taking care of the international
mm-hmm.
Piece. This time Highland became organized on a global basis, and they asked me to do that, and I had the right background to do so.
Right.
And then a little bit later, I became executive vice president, and then I had also manufacturing and pretty much all functions except for human resources. Mm-hmm. And my hope had been to become the president of the division.
Mm-hmm.
That did not happen. I left before that happened.
Right. Yeah, and we'll certainly get into what happened after that. But so the move to Highland was always, you would always plan to come back to the U.S. So once you're back in Europe now, you weren't thinking, finally back in Europe. You were at this point very
I had become
very connected to.
I really had become very connected to the American, not to necessarily to the global aspect, but to the American way of doing it. It was a very, very extremely nice environment.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very challenging, but very, very nice. And I was still in my 20s. By that time, I was early 30s, but it was so rapidly moving.
Mm-hmm.
That it was very, very, very exciting. And I couldn't see one of these stale European firms doing the same.
Right.
I developed biases and all those good things, but I was clearly enthralled
about
by this
American entrepreneurship.
Exactly.
Right.
This was a very entrepreneurial. It was a tremendous camaraderie.
Mm-hmm.
It was in the company, people doing things that never thought they would be doing.
Right.
So when I went to California, it was a great culture shock from Munich to California.
Yeah.
And yet another culture shock to come to Boston, but it was a lot of fun.
Right. So you had the personal goal of becoming president upon that move.
I always, throughout that time, knew eventually I would run a business.
Mm-hmm.
As a younger business CEO, I wasn't distracted by that, but I knew that that's where it would end up. In this case, the opportunity became one of saying, okay, I'm going to be president of this division, and they were very open that that's what's going to happen. And that's why they brought me in running a good size of the division and doing something new that was experimental in the company. And
mm-hmm.
then they gave me more 2 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, Genzyme intervened.
Right. Well, let's talk about what sorts of activities you did at Highland that caused this intersection with biotechnology.
Now, I ran research and development.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the intersection.
Yeah.
Because we were acutely aware of the limitations of plasma.
Mm-hmm.
It was in the late, we had then, at that time we had exposure to non-A, non-B hepatitis, not yet hepatitis C, it wasn't quite identified in that sense.
Right.
But we knew people got non-A, non-B hepatitis, and we couldn't test for it because there was no test for it.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't test the plasma for it. And then a few years later, in 1981, the whole HIV crisis started. And of course Genentech had been started in 76,
mm-hmm.
77 thereabouts, had gone public, was a great success story, and they went, Genetics Institute had been started, Hybridtech had been started, Genex had been started, Biogen had been started, and they of course looked at known proteins early on. They looked at lots of stuff, including Drano and Indigo and whatever. That's it's kind of funny to think of, that people were trying to develop biotechnology companies on the basis of industrial products.
Yeah.
But they, of course, they looked at blood products, number one, because blood products, there was an established market, and it was clearly a crazy way to collect millions of units of blood or plasma,
mm-hmm.
As we were doing. So if you could produce albumin, that would be a good thing. If you could reduce factor VIII, that would be a good thing too. So many of these companies started to really to produce non-proteins.
Mm-hmm.
Genentech started with insulin and human growth hormone, which had a very similar kind of concerns.
I guess insulin was 80 that you went on the market, is that right? Or 81 or something? And growth hormone a couple of years later?
Very early problems.
Right.
And they, you know, it's porcine and cadavers. And real incentives there.
Yeah.
And but the challenges with plasma proteins that are to be much bigger than you couldn't go there very easily.
Mm-hmm.
So we had no recombinant technology at Baxter.
Right.
I had no recombinant technology in my research organization.
Right. When did you learn about it? Did you know about it by 79 recombinant?
Yeah,
technology?
Just by reading the normal
mm-hmm.
literature.
Right.
And by, of course, our researchers were aware.
Right.
These companies would come along because we were a well-known company in the protein business, and
mm-hmm.
they needed money, so they would come along to sell their services.
Right.
And I would go and see them. So I went to all different biotechnology companies, the well-known ones, and we did contracts with a number of them,
right,
to do certain things. For instance, we started a contract with Genetics Institute on factor VIII and factor IX.
Mm-hmm.
We also worked with GI on albumin, and we worked with Hypertech on some highly specific immune globulins,
mm-hmm.
Hybridomas for septic shock, and because in the process of setting up these contracts, you visit people, you negotiate, you make a choice,
mm-hmm.
go there or not there. And you learn a lot.
Right. And you meet people.
Yep, right. You. Sorry, you were saying.
Yeah, and you meet people as
you
well.
You meet people, right. And they get to know you a little bit. But we were a powerful company then because we had money and need, a very obvious need. These
right.
companies really wanted to work with us. And, of course, we knew a lot. Baxter was in the blood business. It's either purifying it through these dialysis machines or collecting it through
right.
Fennel bags or collecting it and then breaking it apart through fractionation.
Mm-hmm.
So Baxter knew a lot. Or
right.
adding IV solutions to it. Through.
Right.
So Baxter knew a lot about blood and blood ingredients.
Which I guess a lot of these companies and people didn't know.
Not as much.
Because they were molecular biologists doing laboratory
right.
R&D, but didn't know how to scale up and do all of the other things that would be required.
And we knew it all about red cells and damaging red cells in which is blood machines and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So we knew about EPO. We knew about TPA.
Right.
There was not that much known, but we knew something about it.
Right.
And that really led to me leaving later on because Baxter did not agree, the senior management. There was a change of CEO at Baxter from Bill Graham to Vern Laux. And the company became much more oriented on the, if you call it, the low-tech side of the healthcare field.
Mm-hmm.
Low-tech is maybe doing it a disservice, but they were not about to go into biotechnology.
Right.
I was not allowed to develop biotechnology capability within Highland. And we were continuously exposed to it.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a report, this is so interesting, I don't know if this is confidential or not, but it's now so old. Done by a consulting firm, I won't use a name, well-known consulting firm, for Baxter. That said that it was too late because the experience curve that had been accumulated in the biotechnology industry, this is early 80s now,
mm-hmm.
Was so large in established companies like Biogen, GI, and Genentech, and Amgen, that to try and catch up is too late.
Mm-hmm.
You have to work with them. You can't catch up anymore.
So a consulting firm concluded that Baxter should be moving into this?
Should not be moving into this.
Oh, should not be, okay.
Because it's too late, because the accumulated experience will be too hard to catch up to.
Right, yeah.
Early ages, well-known consulting firm. You know, bad advice. Of course, we were at the very beginnings of biotechnology then.
Mm-hmm.
And Baxter sort of was finished. Those are already in a mature stage.
Right.
And we had lots of discussions, you know, back and forth within the company. And then, of course, I became vulnerable to look outside, because the company was losing its courage, I thought, at the time. To do new things.
You thought this was the next innovative step that should be taken.
Exactly.
Right.
So I learned a lot at Baxter in a sense. These were blood products, these were proteins. I learned the beginnings of biotechnology as it was done outside of Baxter, by doing contracts and monitoring the performance against the contracts. The limitation of Baxter as a company to really react to this. The limitation of companies that become mature, more mature, of how science gets squeezed the more mature the company becomes.
Right.
Overwhelms the ability to go into the unknown. Because there's so much you know and you're so comfortable with, the number of people employed on the known side is so large, it overwhelms the few that want to go to the pioneering side.
It requires change in the company.
Yeah. So that's what really led me to look at those opportunities.
Okay. Maybe we can pause for one sec before we start talking about
looking
into those